Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Good Monday morning. Assalamualaikum. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Alhamdulillah. Assalamualaikum.
Assalamualaikum. Alhamdulillah. Doing fine this morning.
Talk to us. Making you smile, was making you quake in your boots. Monday morning on the 11th of December.
Yes, December 11th, 2023.
That's right. What's making your stilettos bend over, Sister Masala?
My stilettos? Interesting. Not good for your back, so stilettos. What has me shaking my head is absolute inhumanity of the current leadership of the United States of America, as demonstrated by Mr. Biden in acting, and this is the first time he's done it since he's been in office, enacting his emergency powers to grant aid, billions of dollars, we might add, to Israel, additional aid to Israel, supplying more bombs and weaponry. At the same time, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations vetoing in the Security Council the resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza. I just don't understand. Maybe senility has set into Biden. I don't know what justification he has for participating in the genocide that we see every day. But I guess it's not for me to know. So that has me shaking my head. But I'm happy because the sister that I mentioned last week, Myrna El-Habari, who has the Connecting Gaza nonprofit, they are continuing to provide the eSIMs to journalists, first responders, the medical staff, and everyday people in Gaza to make sure that we can find out what's going on the ground there. And she's also appealing, if you go to Instagram, follow her, _Myrna, M-I-R-N-A. She has an appeal for, they're trying to send 3 trucks for aid to Gaza, and they're about 60% complete with the trucks, and they're asking people to help them to get 1 truck with medical supplies, 1 truck with hygiene products, and 1 truck with food. So I'm very happy to hear that. And I was able to send 2 of the eSIMs. It was a challenge, but I was able to do it. So I'm very happy about that. That's it for me.
Well, that's encouraging news. I guess my good news, or what's making me smile in my heart, is the very successful A Time to Be Grateful event that I was able to participate in Newark, New Jersey, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and unfortunately had to leave out Sunday to attend a funeral back here in North Carolina. But during those first 3 days, we had some wonderful workshops. The workshops included everything from an international banking effort to establish a bank based on Islamic principles. And the young man is working with several different federal agencies to make that happen, with the wealth of experience dealing with foreign countries on how to, of course, organize that same effort. To community engagement workshops, you have some specific workshops related to health, education, culture. And speaking of culture, it was a wonderful culture night that included a couple of brothers from New Jersey who sang the old Delphonic songs. Had Brother Kashi there, who's, of course, the flutist. And then you had some spoken word young people who really had some powerful forms that they presented with the music. So you had a little taste of culture from each one of the generations. That was very inspiring. And we went to the annual banquet, and we were treated to the mayor of New Jersey. He's a powerful young brother, you know, the son of Imara Baraka, who's currently the mayor of New Jersey, or Newark specifically. And he gave a very rousing speech on his support for the publication from our community. He went all the way back to Muhammad Speaks Arab, and he said, listen, in New Jersey, every third person you talk to has an Islamic-sounding name. That's how much influence you've had in this community over the years. But he really took out his lifetime subscription to the paper, and he just encouraged us to realize the importance of what we're doing to be the truth bearer in the community. And then that was accented with the brother from New York, Dr. Yusuf Salam, who was one of those 5 young men who were finally exonerated for that tragedy that happened in New York at Central Park. He's now, of course, Dr. Yusuf Salam. He's written a book, and he's a powerful motivational speaker. And he just shared with how he had to actually go to prison at 15 or 16 and to become familiar with what the meaning of his name was all about. Even though he was born into the community, he had no idea the history behind Yusuf or Salam, and part of his name is also Idris. And he said when he was a young boy, people said, oh, your name is Joseph. He said, no, Joseph sounds nothing like Yusuf. And as a teenager, he would defend himself all the time. But he said he realized he was in the belly of the beast, locked up, with no light at all at one point because of the sentence that he received erroneously, and finally was able to see some light from some encouragement from brothers in the prison situation there, and began to do some serious studying of his own and got to the point where he wanted to begin to write. And eventually he was exonerated for that tragedy that happened in Central Park. But he was a very powerful speaker. Elevated his mother, of course. She's now in her 70s, and how she always stood by him because she knew her child and I'd commit such an atrocious act against any other human being. So that was very, very encouraging. And the place was completely packed. I know at least a minimum of 80 tables in that room, 10 people per table, just for the banquet. So every event was fully supported, and the local imam there in New Jersey was almost brought to tears because of the support that he received. And the Katia for Jumal, you know, Dr. Nasser from Miami, Florida, gave us a very inspiring khutbah lecture on Jumal, sort of kicked things off on Friday. So the whole event, just to be around so many people of the same belief system, supporting each other, being in the same spirit with each other, was a wonderful event. And to break down the workshop that I was engaged in, we had one brother who talked about what's happening in the Congo. I had no idea that there were 7 million people displaced in the Congo while the world is focusing on what's happening in Israel and the tragedy in Gaza. He brought up some of the tragedies happening in the Congo and Sudan, in the southern part of Sudan and Darfur, and how the focus of the world's attention has shifted from those tragedies, unfortunately. But he wanted to bring up to the public attention some of those tragedies happening on the African continent, which was a very good balance. And I, too, was discouraged with the events at the United Nations specifically. I was encouraged that the General Secretary is still going to pursue, even today, requests to bring about a ceasefire. My hope is that they will have enough courage, no different than we did in South Africa with apartheid. We encourage citizens to encourage their governments to divest, to stop supporting any country that would support a system like that. And if we can get the courage of a few nations to do that, to simply stop trading with that country until they establish a ceasefire and start killing those innocent people. You're talking about 17,000 people killed because you feel like you're justified of, 1,400 people being killed in your country. And so there is no balance there. And innocence is the key there. You know, you just cannot, on both sides, kill innocent people and think that that's a blessing or permission given to you by Almighty God. And finally, I read one article from Imam Muhammad about the fallacy of people thinking that a promised land was a physical body of land. The concept behind that is simply a mindset, a religious mindset, that, no promise was made to someone to say that they were secure to take someone else out of their land and call it their own because God said so. And he went into a lot of detail on what that whole concept of means when it comes to the promised land. But it's a mental mindset that can take place in America or anyone else if you really have a God consciousness. So that was very encouraging as well. I'll stop there because I know we have some very enlightened guests today, and I don't want to take up too much time talking. I want to give them full opportunity to assess their theme, which is community engagement and civic responsibilities. So, Cheryl?
Sounds good to me. In the words of the great philosopher, speak only if you can improve silence. I shall be silent. you guys have said it all, so I'm going to be silent. And we have a good show today ready for everyone, so I'm going to let you move it forward. Let's go forward. I say todos, which means that is all I have these morning. Let's go.
Well, thank you very much. Are both of our guests online? Are they available?
Brother LaShawn is online.
All right, then. Well, we'll start with our brother. Let me give him somewhat of a introduction here. He has a lot of history. Relatively young brother, but in his young life, he has been a CEO of three different United Health Centers, federally funded, in Forsyth County for a number of years. He's in the process now of establishing some other interests that he has, but in the process of taking on that major task, he actually was responsible for increasing the budget from $1.4 million to $4.5 million through his specific efforts. His ability to be an effective outreach coordinator included working at one point at Forsyth County Department of Public Health. And he established several programs to encourage students to read more, to understand the value of reading. He worked with Big Brothers and Big Sisters. He also, at Salem State University, brought in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, commonly referred to as NASA, to engage the students on that campus and the programs that they have to offer to get them oriented toward, you know, scientific careers. And just a good brother, well-respected in the community, and very attuned to the value of community engagement. And I could read a lot more from his bio, but I know he'll do more justice than I when it comes to that. So, LaShawn Huntley, thank you so much for being a part of our discussion. And I think I sent you a few questions you might give some thought to consider answering, or anything else you'd like to add to discussion on how important it is to be community engaged in our respective communities. And, of course, Mr. Huntley resides in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, on the East Coast, and I think we all know that I think it's a sign that rises from the east even into the west. That's what I've heard anyway. Ms. LaShawn Huntley. As-salamu alaykum, sir. Did he press one?
There he is.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was just mentioning the fact that, you know, just listening to that, I want to thank the Creator for just allowing me the passion to do this type of work. And then, of course, secondly, my parents. I mean, when you talk about community engagement, this is where I learned to be engaged with the community, and I understood the importance of it, right? And how important it is to get your community engaged. And I'm pretty sure you all heard that when they say community, they're common unity, right? So what is the common unity of a people? Of course, need to have great attitudes, of course, interests and goals. And so my parents not only talked about it, actually modeled that for me. So listening to that, I thank the Creator again. 13 years as a CEO of United Health Centers has brought a lot of experiences around community engagement. And, of course, we do understand that that's allowing the community to have a voice. And so for me in that particular role, I allowed the community, because what we did was we provided healthcare services for anyone. If you wasn't insured, we can provide healthcare for you. And these are doctors who are passionate about people and passionate about the community. And also we provided healthcare to anyone actually who had insurance and Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medicare, Medicaid. But we also provided for the community, we listened to what the community needed, and they needed that type of environment where they felt safe, it was culturally competent. Majority of my staff were definitely trained in cultural competency. So we wanted to make sure that the community, when they got there, they felt comfortable. And that kind of came from my grandmother, who did not have health insurance. She was a maid, and she died through complications that could have been managed if it was a United Health Center during that time. So my passion kind of stemmed from that too as well. So being able to have those individuals and those examples in my life, but I definitely understood the engagement of the community. I know one of the things that my mother always talked about is, you know, to engage the community, you got to make sure you go where the people are, right? So that means go into the communities, go into their neighborhoods, go into the centers around the community. So it's one of the things that she talked about was the importance of community engagement. And, of course, that's to control the, you know, you got to have economic power and, of course, political power. What does that look like? Political power, you got to make sure those individuals in your community have a voice to, and of course, we all know, you know, voting is very important for elected officials to have the sentiments and concerns about the community. So one of the things she talked about was making sure that those elected officials who represented the population heard the people talk about some of the problems and situations they have. So when you do that, you have that economic, or even that political engagement, political power. The second thing was economic power. You know, when we all hear about, you know, how important it is to spend money back into the community. In my role at the organization, we also, the money that we received, we put it back into the organization. It wasn't like we had, now of course, you know, nonprofit organizations, you don't have a huge budget, right? So being in a space where you can utilize that funds and put it back into the organization to provide more services. And so that's what we did. We also engaged the economic power of bringing in funds to the organization to provide care for the community members. Again, we had we started a dental practice where if you didn't have health insurance, you could be seen. Or if you did have health dental insurance, you could be seen as well. We also started a pharmacy. And this is all this came from hearing what the people needed and what the people wanted. And we created a one-stop shop for individuals to come in, to be seen, and take care of their medical, dental, the pharmacy as well. We also have behavioral health as well. So community engagement is making sure you have some type of control where people in the community are able to voice an opinion, a thought, strategize on goals, and accomplish that what is necessary for a community to thrive. But I'm not sure if you want to go into the next question or if there's any questions, because I'm just kind of going for it, so I'm not sure what format you need me to,
well,
to take
you,
this
you,
in.
You're doing an outstanding job. We have to pause for a PSA, you know, those public service announcements,
sure,
to keep things rolling for us. But I want to bring one thing to the attention of our listening audience. You referred to one of them already, but some people don't realize that indeed there are five pillars even for community engagement. And I'll just share them very quickly, and then we'll go into, let's see, where are they? I'm just hitting my fingertips here. Okay, here we go. The five C's: connections, control, cash, and collective action. The five C's of community engagement: connections, control, cash, and collective action. Then they break those down into specific things you should be doing in the community. And you refer to your parents. You know, I had the privilege and the blessing to work with them with Vigils for Healings and put that basic ball down to whenever there was a murder in the city, anywhere, a group of us would find that location and bring the family in, have a vigil, you know, sort of reclaim that spot in the community for the community's benefit, and honor, of course, those that were lost their lives at that specific location. And in most cases, it was an interfaith effort, you know, in doing that, but LaShawn's mother and father got that effort initiated. Just to give you another example of their involvement in community engagement for a number of years, in fact, for decades. So with that said, we're going to come back to Mr. LaShawn Hantley after this station break. I think we knew we were obligated to play at least a couple of PSAs in the course of our program. So if we have one available, now would probably be a good time to play one of those PSAs.
Assalamu alaikum. This is the Preacher Hadi, host of Alice Lyman Focus Learning Lab here on AM 360, inviting you to join me Saturday evening at our new time, 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, as we continue to share inspiring and thought-provoking Islamic education. Inshallah, I will see you in the lab at our new time, 5 to 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Saturday evening. Assalamu alaikum, and thank you kindly.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Sister Khalida Akbar Abdulaziz, Program Manager for American Muslim 360, inviting you to join us every Wednesday night from 7 to 8 p.m. for Narrative Aspiration. Believe, when we aspire, we go higher. Each and every Wednesday night from 7 to 8 p.m. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, and this is Latifa A. Hamid. Join me every second and fourth Sunday from 3 to 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time right here on AM 360 for Relationship Talk as we explore tips and discussion on how to have a healthy, happy relationship. See you there. Assalamu alaikum.
Join us for Muslim American Power 5 on Mondays, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Muslim American Power 5, referred to as MAP5, featuring Sister Amatullah Sabri, Sister Cheryl Sadi, and Brother Fleming Alamein. That's Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time for MAP, Muslim American Power 5.
Back to you.
All right. And again, we're honored this afternoon to have with us Ms. LaShawn Huntley, who has a wealth of experience as a community advocate and engaged in the community for a number of years and being given those guideposts, you could say, to be engaged from his mother and father, who were pillars of leadership also in our community. I think, LaShawn, you went through question number one pretty thoroughly there. You might be able to combine two and three, and I'll read them to the audience. Two says, what are the benefits of community engagement? And three reads, what happens when citizens of the community are not engaged in the progress of their community?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you again. And just kind of going back to the importance of that community engagement and how it, you know, how it's aligned with people in the community, their voice. You know, being able to have a seat at the table is very important. And so there are benefits of that, of course, you know. So some of the benefits, I was thinking as it relates to the work at the health center, United Health Center, the benefits I really thought about was health-wise, right? So your community engagement as it relates to healthcare, bringing dental staff in a situation or behavioral health, having those individuals in the community, the benefit of that, or having those the outreach in the community as far as community engagement allows us to provide more services for our patients. Of course, our patients become more healthy, and community members become more healthy. We had an example of that. We had an African American male. I think he was in his 50s and hadn't been going to the doctor. And so I mentioned to him about the services we provide. He said, "Well, I don't have any health care." And I said, "Well, you're a perfect person for that because this is what we do. You know, we provide health care to anyone." He got there, was seen by one of our physicians. We referred him out to a neurologist, and the neurologist said, if you didn't go to be seen at the health center, you would have been paralyzed from the waist down. And so the power of that community engagement, the benefit of it, you see individuals who are now healthier because of the interaction and listening to the people and providing those services. Another thing, too, that I was thinking about was the benefits of it. You see better schools, too, as well, right? So if the people in the community understand the power they have and having that one voice and then actually putting a plan together and activating that plan, you can improve the schools in your community as well. One of the things I remember going to the masjid, they talked about Sister Claire Muhammad schools, and I was just so impressed on how those schools were ran because those students were able to matriculate through the school fairly quickly with the knowledge, you know, of what's necessary. So we definitely understand the community, how it changes education, how it benefits education, how it benefits the students, and also the individuals in the community. And then, of course, jobs, too, as well. So if you had the community engagement where the voice of the community was again, organized and activated, where we are talking to the individuals who can potentially bring jobs to our communities, we could talk to them about, and I remember, sorry, dating myself, the shop classes and electrician classes, those courses were so important and valuable because a lot of people did not want to go to college. But being able to have a community engaged, you could say, these are some jobs that we need. We need some vocational work. We need some jobs where people can work with their hands, and not everybody are going to college. So community engagement, definitely has several benefits. And, of course, life. You know, when you have a community that supports each other and encourages each other, you know, that's when you have, you know, the benefit of your community engagement. So this is like the safety of your community. It'd be pleasing to see, you know, the environment would be pleasing to the eye. Of course, looking at, you know, if we did not do these things, it would just be the opposite. Brother Flynn, we would not have these jobs that are necessary for our members of our community. We would see the health decline in our community. One of the things I know with the community engagement, how important it is and the benefit of it, is one of our locations, we set up a location health center in an area where there were high infant mortality rates, there were high individuals who have hypertension, diabetic. We was intentional on doing that because we understood the need of the community based on our conversations with the members of the community. So we definitely have to look at this, and of course, you would see the success of community engagement by the success of the people in your community. And I think I'm going to end right there, Brother Flynn. I'm not sure if you wanted me to expand on something else as it relates to the benefits and community engagement and importance of it. But
I think you've done a fantastic job. I'm sure you're going to get some questions from our listening audience. But, you know, to somewhat sum up some of those five C's that we talked about earlier, community, connections, control, cash, and collective action. And the collective action part I didn't refer to earlier, but it allows collective action when you have really effective community engagement and you can address issues like health disparities or wealth disparities, educational disparities, you know, et cetera. But you've got to be engaged in your community. Otherwise, others will engage your community and define your community to their benefit. And too often that happens. You know, I'm of the age when we used to have on every corner, you know, something owned by us that operated for us, made services available to us because of during the era of segregation. But at least we had those services available at our fingertips. And then other programs came along, and all of those establishments, for the most part, were either closed down or removed by something called urban renewal. I called it urban, you know, destruction, but other programs came in and really sort of destroyed the economic foundation in many cases of our communities. And unfortunately, the leadership then could not see the damage on that other end. They only saw one aspect of it. And we collectively have been at a disadvantage historically because of that kind of lack of community engagement for the whole community. I'm going to switch phones because I just heard this phone give me a buzz sound. Can you still hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. If you would, any questions for my co-host while I change phones right quick for Ms. LaShawn Huntley?
I do have one. It might morph into two, but good morning, Mr. Huntley.
Good morning.
The question that I have, I guess, would involve at least two of those C's that Brother Fleming was talking about. And I asked him this question a couple of weeks ago, I guess, now. I was surprised that it took 10 years for your state legislature to agree to expanding Medicaid because of their opposition to the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. Can you share with our audience how much community engagement was involved in bringing about that change in the state legislature, and then also with the governor signing this into law, how will this benefit your health centers and other health centers and the population that you serve?
Sure. Yeah, so I agree. It took so long for this to happen. When I started in 2010, there were rumors of Medicaid expansion, right, and how how beneficial it would be for us as an organization to have that expansion. And so one of the things we used to do and still do, but once in particular before they actually voted, was each year we would go to D.C. And we called it, Capitol Hill. We would just like a march on Capitol Hill, to put it plainly. And what we would do, we'd go to our elected officials and talk with them about how important it is for Medicaid to expand for individuals in our community. We're talking about veterans who are not covered by any insurance, and they can be covered.
Mm.
We have mothers who have children. Of course, they have Medicaid, but those mothers also need health care, right? To be healthy,
right.
So those are the things we did. So every year, even though if you know D.C., is super cold in the wintertime. So, and me coming from North Carolina was like, oh, my God. So we would walk Capitol Hill, and we would have those meetings with these elected officials to share with them how important it would be to have Medicaid expansion. But each year, as you know, we would have these rumors of Medicaid expanding, and next thing you know, like, well, it's not going to happen. So, this is definitely we should be definitely proud of the work that individuals across the country have done and individuals here in North Carolina have done, and as it relates to Medicaid expanding in our state of North Carolina, because over 600,000, and as they say, 600,000 individuals will now be eligible for health care coverage. And like I mentioned in that story with that, the African-American male, what if, right? So what if that is one incident, but we know, because we know people who don't have health insurance, and their health and their life is suffering. So the benefit of that Medicaid expansion is going to be able to, we'll be able to see a lot more individuals. Cause of course, once they get Medicaid, they feel proud. I remember when the ACA came about, and we had individuals who in the community were saying, I have health care. I can actually go see a doctor, and they were proud of it. They were proud of it. They would show me their card. This is what I have, because we got to think about the fundamental need for us to be vibrant citizens. You have to health as well. I think people say that all the time, and that's so true. And so when you have this Medicaid expanded, so we have an opportunity to really serve a lot more people, improve lives, change communities. So I'm really excited about the Medicaid and the expansion of Medicaid in North Carolina. But it took a long time, as you know. But it took a lot of work, too, going to talking to the elected officials and just letting them know how important it is for Medicaid to expand.
Can you, just as a follow-up, I could not, and I still can't understand why elected officials would vote against something that benefits their constituents, especially like in rural areas where many hospitals have closed down and, people just need to have affordable health care. When you spoke with some of these officials, what was their line of reasoning why they would oppose something like that? Was it just simply because
it was associated with President Obama, or, and it wasn't costing the state. This was federal money that was coming
right,
in.
Right, federal dollars.
So, so it didn't have a negative impact on the state budget. I'm not understanding.
Yeah, so I spoke to a congressperson, female, went to her office in Clemens, sat down with her, talked to her about the organization. So we get to the part, this is before Medicaid expanded, of course, about Medicaid expansion. So her view was everyone should be able to pull themselves up from their bootstraps. So her reasoning behind not voting for Medicaid expansion is the fact that everyone should pull themselves up from the bootstraps. So I mentioned to her, you know, Caucasian female, mentioned her, and she gave me her story about her being poor, and she grew up in the mountains, you know, of North Carolina, but she went to Chapel Hill. And so her and her husband. So she gave her that example, and I mentioned to her is, my comment to her was, that's, you know, and I, to be white, you have a privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
And privilege is, it extends to you on so many levels. You know, you could be poor white is a whole different than poor black. Totally.
Yes.
So for her, in her mind was, we were poor. Everybody should, if I can do it, anybody else can do it. So that was a, that was her, and she's a Republican, of course, but that was her, that was her answer to when I talked to her about expanding Medicaid in the state of North Carolina. Now she was very blunt with hers. So, but the other Republicans that I spoke to were just saying, you know, just they don't see how it's going to benefit a lot of people. It's going to cost us money, and I mentioned to them, you know, there's no federal dollars coming in. So they were very, you know, trying to be, I guess, politically correct. But again, she was like, this is what I feel, and people should get themselves up and working, get insurance. So that was her thought. I hope that answered your question. But that was my experience. But a lot of people, the other ones were very politically correct. They were just saying what they're trying to be in a way. They were just saying how it wouldn't help that many people. So.
That's something. Privilege
yes.
can really block people. I mean, well, what about veterans who they may not have any more boots? You know, they may have given their legs up in Afghanistan or Iraq War or Vietnam.
That's right.
So
that's right. And I had to leave because, you know, I got really upset with her because I'm like, she just could not see past the fact that there's privilege that she, you know, that's extended to her. She has this privilege that's extended to her. Without her even seeing it, there's other people who just don't have that,
mm-hmm.
period. And
yeah.
I experience a lot of uninsured patients who are seen and are so happy about just the service that United Health Centers provide to them. So, yeah, so that was my experience with the state of Carolina. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, no problem.
That's all that I have for the film. Well, I think that.
Okay.
Yeah,
I would add one other factor to the legislation being passed by the General Assembly in North Carolina. You know, Monday after Monday after Monday, there was a movement in North Carolina called Moral Mondays. And these Moral Monday movements were led by a coalition of different grassroots organizations spearheaded
mm-hmm.
by Dr. William Barber, the president of Poor People's Campaign. And we met down there on Mondays outside the General Assembly with a host of different coalitions. And then we would leave the rally and actually enter into the General Assembly building and present our, quote, demands to the key legislators. Now, that took on, my God, how many years? We were, almost 8 years we were down there. And finally, year number 10, you could say they
yep.
saw the light. But they saw the light and signed it into law attached to a budget approval. Now, many of those guys, and I worked across, as they say, the line on many occasions, many of them were blindsided by the word Obamacare, even though the name of the legislation was Affordable Health Care. They coined the phrase Obamacare just to put some kind of suspicion in the average person's mind that this is going to somehow hurt them, when in fact it only helped them. But in North Carolina, finally, the guy who sort of became the budget director to a great degree from Forsyth County, Danny Lambert, he was a former health, in fact, he was the administrator of a hospital here, a major hospital, and also served on the school board. And he finally gave his green light because he tried to write a complimentary proposal to health care, and he finally said, well, look, I can go along with this if this happens. And so they passed it, contingent upon the state assembly passing the budget. Now, why was that such a quagmire? We had a Democratic governor, Governor Roy Cooper, the Senate controlled by Republicans, and the House having a narrow, narrow, narrow majority of Republicans also. They couldn't agree. It went back and forward on the budget. So when the budget was finally approved, and of course Medicaid came through as well, that's just some of the inside story that's not discussed that much. But it took a swell of grassroots organizations to put pressure on the legislators. The average politician does not respond to just moral consciousness. They respond to pressure from the public, generally speaking. And I've been in D.C. talking to congressmen and senators and et cetera, speakers, et cetera, for a number of years. And you can present your resolution to them. You can present solutions with your resolutions. And then you're somewhat at their mercy to agree, you know, or disagree with you. But the public outcry on a continuous basis makes a big difference. It makes a big difference. I don't mean to interfere with you. Response, which I just wanted to add that comment in there because it was the Poor People's Campaign who really, really pushed the General Assembly of North Carolina to do the right thing, you could say, in regards to Medicare finally being expanded. Yeah. And now they're celebrating.
Right.
What a good thing we did for North Carolina, right?
Right, when it comes to that story. They'll stick out their chest and say that, oh, yes, well, I voted for the expansion. You know, this year, and not talk about the 9 year, 9 or 10 years that they opposed it.
Exactly.
Right.
There's another example.
Really calls for voters to be alert and informed.
Yes.
And know the back history of the people who come up for election.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that's also part of the importance of community engagement, too, being able to inform your constituents or the constituents or the individual voters who's going to vote about the candidates, right? You know, we've talked about that several times. Like, how do we engage those individuals in a way where there's a report card created on each elected official, you know, when that report card consists of several criteria that the community wants to see happen.
That's very important. Like this year we had the African American Caucus of the NAACP came up with the report card. and the report card basically reflected the voting history of our local elected officials, you know, and some of the state people as well. But there are other organizations that do this similar kind of work. The League of Women Voters have a report card. You have several nonprofit groups that do that kind of thing, but it's absolutely necessary. And sometimes you get discouraged because you can't get a room full of people to discuss agendas or a room full to discuss the need to be informed, but you just thank God, thank the Creator for the ones you get, and go to work. Don't be discouraged. Just keep focused. And eventually, you know, the crowd will come around with the initiatives. It only takes a few concentrated, concerned people to make a world of difference in the world opinion eventually. But I didn't want to get off course too much, so I know that we also had invited Linda Sutton to come on. Has she come on the green board yet? If not, we're going to continue with our civic responsibilities that's related to this discussion of community engagement.
Before you do that, when you're talking about...
No, I'm sorry, Cheryl. Yes.
It's okay. Just really quickly, on civic engagement, and I think Sister Mapala will be right back on to talk about your next guest. when you're talking about civic communities, because you also have the affinity groups, right? You have the league. You have the, you know, all of these affinity groups that also do report cards. But the thing about engagement, especially when you talk about like black and brown voters, and you talk about Muslim voters or, you know, younger voters, you really have to have something that's compelling to a voter in order to engage them. And I think that part of the issue is that, you know, a lot of voters are issue-based, right? They got to have something that's going to get in. Like when we talk, the first thing we talk about when we get on the show is what has you quivering in your boots or what has you stay up at night, what has your heart thumping. So most of the time, you got to have people, you got to really have people, you got to snatch them up by the wig or by the temblance, right? Most people are not us. They're not us. They're not like, you know, political. They're not going to do it when it's boring. They're not going to do it every moral Monday. Like, doing this every day. And, you know, I look at news like five different channels every day. Most of them are not like that. You know, you gotta snatch the laces out the tins to get them going somewhere. You know, they gotta have a, there's gotta be a stress to them, right? They gotta break a heel, break a nail. They gotta have that weave snatched off. They gotta have something that makes them say, wait, who is pulling the thread out of my hijab? So, that's what I think. And brother, this is what I wanted to talk about, Brother John, is, you know, how do we get people who, because people by nature are apathetic. And let's just be honest, we're apathetic, you know, and I'm on the younger end of this spectrum. And so I'm just going to say, I know my peers. They don't care. They don't care until it hits them in the face. They say, wait, what? It's going to affect my ability to go see Steph Curry and the Warriors because I'm not going to have any money. They know they can't pay the PG&E bill, but if PG&E got to wait so I can go get my Warriors tickets, PG&E, don't have to wait. I got some candles at home. That's what people, that's how they think. They just be real. They're like, I got some candles. They will wait in line at a Black Friday sale before they wait in line to get inside the school to go see what's happening at a back-to-school night or parents' night or Board of Education meeting. When do they go to Board of Education meeting? When did they go? When somebody called somebody at NIG or when they heard that, you know, they're about to cut out sports in the school or the black quarterback got benched for the little blonde one. That's when they go. So how do we keep people constantly engaged without there having to be a crisis? That's the question on the table. There's the question on the table. And then how do we come up with a national agenda that's not always tilted towards an ism or an istic, right? Misogynistic, you know, pluralistic, Islamophobic or anti-Semitic or racism or sexism, like that. Not the ism or the istic. How do we keep people constantly engaged? Because most people will vote against their interest until they figure out that, damn, that ain't working for me. That's the question I have for you. Sir.
She only asked you five questions in one, but go right ahead, LaShawn, then I'll help you out, my brother.
That's what I do.
Here's the thing. I think, you know, I agree with you with that. I mean, my mother said, if you really want to know how an elected official feels about you or cares about you, walk outside and look around in your community. And that shows you how much they care. So if your community is poor or ran down, this is how much they care about you or don't care about you. So I agree. So what do we do to snatch people's wigs or off? I like that analogy. That's a great question. I mean, what do we do, right? I think the same things that we've been doing for years and years is just say people come out here and vote. Let's do a vote. I think to be able to hear what people, what would really make a person vote for another person. I think holding them accountable is one thing. But again, like you said, we need to come together and formulate a plan, a goal. What do we want to see happen? How do we make, how do we hold these individuals accountable? What do we want to see change in our community? I talked about schools, jobs, health, community overall. So what are some things that we want to see happen, and what would really make you vote? I think that those are great questions. I think for me, having the right answer or the correct answer in that question is fleeting. I mean, so what do we do? That's a great question. I think asking your peers, what do you think your peers would, why they don't vote, and then what would make them vote? I guess that would be a good question to your peers. Brother Philemon, again, like I said, that's a great question. I mean, I scratched my head too about this. Like, what is it that's going to jar these people, move these people to really vote, and why? And again, I think if they don't see anything change in their community, and the question is like, why should I vote, right? I still got the same job that's not paying me anything. My community still looks like this. You know, my schools are really messed up. High crime in my community, so why should I vote? You know, so that's a great, great question. So, Brother Fleming, if you want to take it from there, but that's a great question.
Yes, excellent question, and so relevant. The people on this call know that I have 5 young adults. Well, my son just turned 50, he's not quite young anymore, but I have 5 younger people in my house who always tell it to me straight up, and they don't have to give me any chaser with it either about their concerns and the issues. For many of them, always, especially my youngest one, Abraham, who's, you know, got an expertise when it comes to, you know, the whole coding effort and computer intelligence, and got a double major in computer design and computer programming. His interests sort of focus on sort of career issues. He's relatively young. If it doesn't sort of hit him in the face and his environment, you know, he only responds because daddy asked him to. But I think to respond to it in general, you can't be discouraged, first of all. And I've been in this game since A. Phil Randolph was around, registering people to vote. In fact, I worked with Linda Seddon on a campaign to get people registered to vote by baiting them. Come and get your hot fish sandwich at local 222 and a registration form to register to vote. And you know people showed up to get that hot fish sandwich. But that was an issue they all could agree on. I like hot fish. Okay, well, what's the price I got to pay? Okay, I'll sign this form. But the issues change over time. You know, I'm old enough to remember how we campaigned just to get 18-year-olds the right to vote. And why was that an issue? Because so many of us were dying in the Vietnam War and couldn't even vote in this country. So that caused a massive response. Many people who could afford it went to Canada. They said, I'm not going to fight for this country. If they won't let me vote, I'm out of here. You know, they could afford to go. But the majority of our people had to go, you know, in the jungle experience. And many came out with all kind of conditions, some of which impact them today, especially in the homeless population. So the issues will vary over time. But those of us that have this as a driving passion, we sort of have to stay focused and always be in tune with what the issues are in the community. And that's the drawback. I've been in some communities in Winston-Salem, for example, some very challenging communities, and, you know, we was passing out T-shirts, trying to get people to come down to vote, and I had one mother come out of the house cursing this little child out like a sailor. And I said, my God, what is this? I don't mean light cursing. I mean every other word cursing. Boy was about 5 or 6 years of age. I felt sorry for the kid. Get your so-and-so back in the house. What you doing, so-and-so? And all she was trying to do was really protect him from people that he didn't know. That was really her driving point, you know. So what I did in the end, I said, listen, you take the T-shirts. We're here just to let you know what's happening. And she pointed to a garbage can that was overflowing because the landlords didn't have the interest in coming out there to enter this huge, massive green trash can, trash overflowing all around the drink can. And she said, if you get that move, you got my vote. It was that simple. So if you're not aware of your community, If you're not aware of the needs in the community won't listen to you. So you can't go by just talking about principles. We talk a lot today about a threat to democracy. But what does democracy mean in the core of a community that has trash thrown all about? They don't have access to food, don't have access to good health. You got to really make it real for them and make it practical. And I'm not going to take a lot of time, but I'll give one last example. One of the key persons who got me involved in the whole political arena was former County Commissioner Maisie Woodruff, God rest her soul. She said to me, I was much younger then, she said, Flipman, you got 5 babies. You want to feed your babies? Don't you know, son, the politicians control the price of bread? If you want to feed your babies, you better get involved and quit criticizing. Because I was very critical. I said, politicians do one thing. They tell you what you want to hear and do what they want to do once they get in office. She said, baby, it's only going to change if you get involved. Now, she was my catalyst. In fact, when I became a county commissioner, I gave her all the credit for really getting me involved on a real personal level. And that's why I got involved in politics as a precinct chairman and eventually the chair of the party, eventually the state executive committee member, et cetera, and finally some elected positions. But that issue, me feeding my 5 babies, oh, that hit home. I said, wow, she hit that right on the nail right there. Boy, I got to feed these babies. I'm looking at them every day. I mean, no way to get around that. So we have some issues in the community today. You know, we have some kids who are detached from engaging in community, period. You know, and people take advantage of that, especially some of these shrewd politicians, you know. I call them used car salesmen. They come around only when it's election time. And so I always tell people, listen, you have your own forum in your community and invite them to come and see who shows up. If they don't show up in your community other than election time, they don't really have your interest at all. They just car salesmen saying, vote for me and I'll save the world for you. But that's pie in the sky kind of campaigning. That's my take. Don't be discouraged. Just keep on working because you're motivated by a higher authority. I'll put it that way. And some people like the wind blowing. They blow in another direction, and there's no stability to them. So stay encouraged and just know you're doing the right thing to help the quality of life in your community. And eventually some people come around. It took me about 10 years to get the young man to take my place. But I think he's going to run next year finally. All right. That's enough for me. All right. All right.
Well, you know, I think sometimes, like what you shared, Brother Fleming, I think sometimes it's that one-on-one person dialoguing with you. That woman, she must have been so frustrated by her situation with the trash can that she could only point to what was the immediate thorn in her side at that time. And the activist that you mentioned, the woman, which she knew that you were someone who was a responsible father, and so that feeding your children would hit your interest. Like you said, it hit the nail right on the head. I think it takes sometimes that one-on-one with a person. I think about myself, because my best friend and I, the light bulb started going on in our head through this older brother who I guess maybe he must have been about 10 or 12 years older than us. And he shared with us, this brother, I think his name was Ernest Cole. He had a picture book called House of Bondage, and it was about South Africa. And that was the first thing that kind of turned a light bulb on in my head about being socially engaged or community engagement. And the Panthers were probably getting prominence around that time, so he talked to us about the Panthers, and he talked to us about all of these political movements, you know, about the Martin Luther King and SNCC and all of that at that time. This was in the 60s. And so, and we were young. We were like 12, maybe 13. I don't think we were quite 13 yet. So that
was a seed that was planted, and then as you go on in your life, you kind of gravitate to, like you said, collective action or some kind of community engagement because that seed has been planted. With Brother Huntley, his mother and father, they were role models to show him, you know, right on the ground, as they say, this is what you have to do to get things done. So I think what happens is so many people are waiting for the other guy to do it or the other guy to hold somebody accountable rather than taking on the responsibility their own self as an individual. So I think we have to, those of us who are engaged politically, civically, and some kind of community engagement, we have to take it on ourselves. I think you mentioned it, Brother Fleming, about the ACGG initiative about Take Five, you know.
Yes.
If you have to have five people that you take to the poll, that you have them registered to vote, and that you, you know, encourage and get them to the poll. And, you know, perhaps this is a way that we can get more people actively involved and engaged.
Yeah, we passed out quite a few pledge cards along to join Take Five campaign at a time to be grateful, and people were very responsive to it. So we're going to continue pushing that effort. That individual responsibility, individual effort makes all the difference. And you remind me, Sister Montilla, about an award that was given at the banquet. This sister, her husband was in prison for 54 years. She went to visit him. Yes, and they gave both of them an award at the banquet. It was so moving, you know. And he said, you know, how, well, what the relationship was like for her to wait 54 years for him, first of all. And then the difference that it made in his life to have that connection and how it saved his life, because he was turned down so many times. It all boiled down to a situation with the police that he was able to... not to lose the battle, but he said had there been cameras at that time, he would have never gone to jail because the police started. He just finished it. But he was in prison for 54 years.
Yeah,
can you imagine? Yes, it's a lifetime. You know, he finally got his, you know, release from prison, and they're starting their life. And as soon as he got released, of course, the sister said, it's not for me to leave the newspaper business. I got business at home to take care of. So she made a joke out of it, you know, but it was so encouraging. So very encouraging. And that can be multiplied on many levels in our community. But I don't want to avoid answering questions on the people who have called in. Ms. Linda said, and she's on the line, I want to give her an opportunity to share some of her vast knowledge when it comes to civic responsibilities.
Give me one moment.
Yes, ma'am. And I'll just sort of give her a little slight introduction here. It would take me 30 minutes to give her justice, but Miss Linda Sutton, oh my God, she has so many links in the community. She's been involved in educating people, registering people, building coalitions for decades in Winston-Salem. In fact, we call her our local Fannie Lou Hammer. She's that, and she can sing on top of that. But she takes no prisoners when it comes to civic responsibilities. And as she's been in the vineyard, as I said, for years and years and years, and currently serves as a regional coordinator for a nonprofit group called Democracy North Carolina, one of many hats that she wears, and one of the co-founders of Justice Collective, which is an organization with about 22 different organizations that work together on common causes in the community. She spearheads that effort, but her gist is education and voter registration. And the third element is continued participation. You can't be a one-factor entity in this political process. You got to be educated, you got to be registered to vote, and you also got to be a consistent participant on some level beyond just voting. And she will put you to work anytime and plug you in to some work that needs to be done in the community. And I have a lot of respect and nothing but genuine love for the work she's done for decades in this community. That's Ms. Linda Sutton, and a brief biography someone I consider my friend on many, many different levels, and someone to admire. She's never given up. And like I said, she's been a crossfire for a long time with this effort called Civic Responsibility. If she's on the line, we're going to bring her on and let her take over to respond to those questions. I think she had questions 4 through 7 on my suggested outline that I gave her. I think Cheryl said give her a few seconds. Is she on?
I don't see her on. I don't see her on the line yet. But
okay.
there is a hand that's up that from the internet that maybe we should. Or did you get that one yet?
Yes, let's go ahead and respond to the hands that are raised.
Okay.
Any questions they might have.
Hands are raised. Okay.
Yes.
You're on map 5. Go ahead.
Assalamu alaikum.
Yeah, Amatullah.
Amatullah, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I just had a brief comment regarding when people complain, especially if it's on a one-on-one basis or at a meeting or whatever, I think it's good for us to ask them, well, what is it that you would like or what was it that you want? Because in doing that, it makes them take a little bit of accountability in terms of considering what it is that they want, because sometimes people, they have general feelings of dissatisfaction, but they don't take the time to pinpoint it. So the other thing they would do, too, is help them to see, well, we can answer them because sometimes what they're asking for is not even within the range of the particular office that they're criticizing or complaining about. So then when we ask them, then we say, well, that's not in this particular office. That the solution to that would be in this particular office. So that's just my comment, just to, as a way of asking a question first before we give the answer or before we take the complaint, to help the person to kind of clarify what it is that they want and to make sure that they are looking in the right direction for what it is that they want, for the solution they're seeking. So that's my comment.
Well, thank you very much, Sister Imrani. You know, for those who don't know, her family is also very much involved in the civil rights movement for years and years and years. So she has a wealth of experience in that regard as well. I know since you mentioned asking people what their questions may be, we did a preliminary presentation during the workshop on our national survey, and there were all kind of people wanting me to send them a full report that were present at the meeting. And that survey basically asks the questions, what are the issues that you're concerned about on a local level, on a state level, on a federal level? You know, they refer to those as kitchen table or water fountain, you know, discussion issues. But a lot of people in our community talk about safety in their communities as an issue. Public education, that's an issue. Some talked about, you know, some international concerns, but a lot of them were local issues that impacted the quality of life, and that was what we sort of used as a part of our agenda, was sort of fine-tuned. We had one list on American Coalition for Good Government, but we're going to amend it based on the results of this survey. And what really stood out was that the level of participation that we've had as a community has been greater than 80% historically, and in some areas it's been 90%, so they cannot say that we don't participate. And that allows us to speak with a larger voice in many different areas. But Sister Moroni, you're so correct. That's why education and voter registration goes hand in hand. Many people don't know. Having served as a county commissioner, you know, for 5 years, we made a policy decision that any of those ARPA funds that came into the state, the county budget, we would make sure that 80% of those funds went into qualified census tract communities. Now, what does that mean? Those communities that were impacted negatively before COVID, during COVID, and after COVID, primarily us. So if you didn't have a program you presented to us that's going to impact those communities, then you didn't get support. But it was not an easy thing to do to get those commissions to agree. In fact, the vote was, I think in the end it was a 5-2 vote. We still had two people that just refused to go along with that because they knew that most of the money would come into our communities. That's just one example of many I could give you. But you've got to be involved. You've got to respond to people's questions. And some people, because they don't have the civic education, they may come to you with an issue that, you know, can only be handled on a state level or with the Department of Social Service or the Department of Public Health, or there's an agency dealing with homelessness that can immediately give them some assistance. But they think, in some cases, you can wave a magic wand and solve any issue they bring before you. So educating the public is always a constant when it comes to public life and being honest about it and having some integrity about it as well. Any other hands been raised on the green board, as they say?
No, don't see any more. But can we tie in Sister Omrani's comment with your position? Okay. And this is what I mean. If I'm in California or Texas or Missouri, maybe I don't know what a county commissioner does, what kind of power they have, what areas do they impact or influence. So you say you were a commissioner for 5 years, county commissioner for 5 years, Forsyth County. What was your responsibility? So that lady that you saw with the trash can that was overflowing, could you help her as a county commissioner to get that trash can emptied?
As a county commissioner, I would, because I have a list of people who work for the city, I just called the city, you know, sanitation director and gave him the information I received from her and expressed to him that as the county commissioner, I really would like for him to respond to that immediately. Even though it's not in my purview, statutorily, as a county commissioner, it's a city issue. But that boils down to having good relationships with those directors of those city departments. So he was very responsive. He said, Brother Fleming, the city's about to give them some charges, the managers or the owners of the complex, because we don't just get calls about sanitation. We get calls about almost anything you can imagine. And the police has been out there 12 times in 1 week. So we're about to charge these people for being negligent and having a hazardous living environment. But I'll be glad to respond to the request, you know, to go out there and make sure that the trash can, and it was a private company that had the contract to move that out, but that was my response. But that's just one example. But if I give you a brief background on the responsibilities of county commissioners, each state is a little different. Statutorily, in the state of North Carolina, we have 100 counties. Some people just have 5 county commissioners, some have 7. Larger cities like Charlotte, North Carolina, might have up to 20. In fact, I think they have 25. But the commissioner's responsibility centers around 4 areas. All public funds for public education are allocated from the county commissioners. So if you got an issue with the school board comes to the county commissioners to be funded. That's one statutory responsibility. A second one, the sheriff's department, your public safety. The sheriff's department is funded through the county commissioners. Third one, your Department of Social Services and Public Health both get a big chunk of their funds from the county commissioners. Fourth one, you have something they refer to as community values or something like public libraries, for example, something the community would really like to see established. Those kind of funds also come from the county commissioners. And those are the charges in terms of statutory requirements that your county commissioners are responsible for. And it's the only entity that serves a whole county. For example, we have 5 cities and a county for site: Winston-Salem, Kernersville, Clemens, Walkertown, and Rural Hall. Well, all 5 of them at one point come to the county for some kind of resources. So we have a county responsibility versus just a one municipality responsibility. So, yes. I've had people come to my office to talk about some realtors who they were misled about buying some property, And though we have no specific, you know, responsibility, I could always call someone if I have a relationship and say, listen, this is an issue in my office right now. Can you help this constituent? So maintain those relationships gives you greater influence than just your role as a county commissioner. But that gives you a short summary of what the responsibilities are. Because we shop in the stores and we go to different locations for recreation, usually the county commissioners are available and people stop you anywhere you are and let you know what the problems are and how can you help them today. I got a traffic light out. I got a light out in front of my house. It's been out for 10 days. And I realized that's a city responsibility. I said, okay, well, you know, I'll call someone for you. But right now I'm just trying to get my bag of, you know, lettuce and some tomatoes and get back to the house and have me a bite to eat. But I'm glad to take your name and I'll pass it on. If they don't get in touch with you in 3 days, you call me back and we'll deal with it. But many, that's also a lack of knowledge. And I think sometimes it's not intentionally. You know, what are the city responsibilities? You know, the city parks, the city concerns, just related to the city government that they're charged with, you know, statutorily to be responsible for. The you know, county concerns that they're charged with. So you look at the statute that governs that entity, whether it be the city or the county or the state for that matter. Many people think that federal government funds public education. They give the least amount. The bulk of your money comes from property taxes. Who controls property taxes? Your county commissioners. So the property tax base is really the essence of the budget for any county level of government. They get their money from property taxes. And the disparity when it comes to public education, some communities don't have a strong property base because there's very little development there, or the housing situation such that there's very little taxes taken, sometimes very little taxes taken, and so you don't have the resources in some communities. And that's the biggest disparity when it comes to public education. By relying on property taxes, you automatically discriminate resources to those that don't have a strong property tax base. Now, the state's supposed to step in and take care of your teacher's salary, you know, and sometimes you've got to push the state to do that. And the state constitution is where you have the obligation to provide a public education. It's in the state constitutions. The federal government might support a Title I program or a reading program, but there's no money, big dollars. You get some dollars, but the bulk of the money comes from your local property tax base and your state. And that's the biggest trouble with that whole system of public funding for public education. Now, that was a whole lot said to answer one simple question. I hope they answer your question, Susana Matula.
No, but that gives I related to an incident that I had. I had a doctor's appointment, and for some reason, I think my primary care had an old address for this doctor. They had sent me a card, you know, this is your appointment, whatnot, and I happened to turn the card over, and it was in a whole different city. I'm thinking I'm going to downtown Oakland. And this was sending me out to a little suburban area, Lafayette, California. So when I called them, they said, well, we haven't been there in 8 years. I'm like, wait a minute, this is crazy. But anyway, long story short, when I spoke to the doctor and I told him, he said, oh, yeah, I've been out of there a good 4 years. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, you know, they started breaking into the cars and whatnot, and we didn't have a parking lot, and so people were, you know, patients were affected. So now I said, and now when we went into his office, my daughter went with me, when we went into his office, there were about three patients. On the other side, they had physical therapy area. The side that I went on, it was three patients. He's a shoulder doctor. And this is how I know that I'm old. I went in there. Then by the time we came out, when I went through the reception room again, there were about 15 or 20 patients in there. And I'm like, look at all this money this man is pulling in. So now here's a business that had to leave Oakland because of the lack of public safety. And therefore, that business tax base was lost to Oakland. And Lafayette is a more affluent area. Now they get that business tax base. And so what you're saying about the property tax, if you live in a part of a city where there's a lot of public housing, Does the Public Housing Authority pay property tax? Are they included in the property tax base?
You know,
it was
housing. I'm not sure because they're tied into the federal government, most of them. Like, there's the Winston-Salem Public Housing Authority that governs
mm-hmm.
all of the public housing in Winston-Salem, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the county did build some apartment units because we got some funds, and we just happened to have a guy in our community development office who found a grant to build some, quote, housing for, you know, that was needed for affordable housing units. So that was just one, two. I think it's maybe four units over there. But the bulk of the housing, when it comes to that kind of situation, are governed by what's called the Winston-Salem Housing Authority. Now, they're tied into a lot of federal resources. And I know they do what they call coupons or Title 8 or Section 8 for people
right.
to underwrite the costs. Yes. And a lot of that is tied into federal regulations. So I'm not sure about the tax base per se. I'd have to ask about that. LaShawn, do you know more about that?
But the reason why I asked is because
okay.
generally the public schools that are near these pockets where you have public housing, generally those public schools are the ones that do not have enough resources.
Right.
So when you said about the property tax, that, you know, the built-in discrimination thing, my mind automatically went to, well, okay, well, what about these public schools that are in these areas where you have primarily the public housing? It seems like that's a built-in. When the brother earlier was talking about privilege, you know, and bootstraps and that whole argument, well, he is a system. And when you talk about systemic racism or discrimination or whatnot, people want to deny that. But if it's set up with these kind of models, you can see why if that child lives in that public housing and the school that he goes to is under-resourced, you see that he has two strikes against him right there starting out.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, when I think about it, I think you're absolutely right because a lot of people don't know that your universities are nonprofit entities, your hospitals for the most part, nonprofit entities,
yes.
your churches, religious institutions. So in Forsyth County, for example, you know, we have Wake Forest University, major university in the city, Winston-Salem State University, major, Salem College, now called International, they changed the name to International Biblical something, major. All the public schools, they don't pay taxes. You know, so you got a core that you get no resources from. Oh, when I say resources, I mean taxes from. So I'm pretty sure that public housing must fall into that category once I think about it, because I know the revenue sources for the county government. The city budget is different. Even the city budget relies a lot on property taxes. So if you don't own the property, there's no revenue coming into the city or the county. In our case, we have a county tax and we have a city tax, and now we have added onto that a water sewage charge as well, which some people are still raising sand about because water bills have been going up lately. But if you live in a community where you have a huge public housing, I doubt if there's a lot of resources coming from those, now that I think about it, in terms of, because the ownership is public, it's not privately held, so you wouldn't have a revenue of dollars coming in from that situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
But Slim, I had a question.
Yes, sir.
So we talked about community engagement and the importance of political power, economic power. I was just curious because I know in our community, I live in East Winston. So for those who don't know Winston, East Winston is 2705, has the highest everything, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so it's everything. But there are schools in our community that are low-performing schools and been low-performing schools for years. And you mentioned that the county commissioners are, quote-unquote, are responsible for funding. However, there's a school board.
Yeah.
So what, like the sister mentioned, what do we need to do to snap some wigs off, right, to make some changes in these low-performing schools? Because at the end of the day, we are, you know, we got students who are in those schools, and we're setting them up for failure, right? Because if you know, everybody knows that third grade students drop out of school, not physically but mentally, because of the reading scores. So how do we make those changes where, and I know it goes back to civic responsibility, right? Voting for school board members who have the sentiments and the concerns of people in the community. But again, it goes back to all those individuals vested in people in those communities. So it's like quite a few questions there, but I'm saying, like, what do we need to do to move that needle of those low performing schools to a space where we, because of course we're sending students there every year, which is like, to me, it's like you're sending children there to die, basically. Because at the end of the day, they're low performing, they're not going to do well in the course test. When they get to middle school, it's going to be the same situation, high school, graduation, if they graduate, then you have a individual potentially could live in poverty for the rest of their lives, and then their children. So we're kind of creating this whole factory of who's responsible, but what do we need to do in that aspect? I know you're county commissioner, so what do we need to do in that aspect? Because that concerns me as a resident here. Like, we have a lot of low performing schools in the black communities, black and brown communities, but you don't see any changes. And I'm gonna stop there. But you don't see any changes. It's still the same. We still have that low performing school in our community.
Yeah, Brother LaShawn, the starting point to make a change is indeed the policymakers for the school system. Who makes the policies for the school system are your school boards. They make the policies, but the money for the policies, big chunk of that money, comes from your county commissioners. So you got to have a two-tier strategy. Pressure on the local school board, because they're making day-to-day decisions. 9 members on the board, and some of them represent districts that have a whole bunch of low-performing schools in there. And just like your mother told you, if you want to go see how concerned they are, walk outside in your community and see if you see any changes, the same analysis applies to schools. If you have a school board member representing, let's say, District A or District B, and you don't see an improvement in those schools, that school board representative is not doing his or her job, because that should be the primary focus. And if they're not getting those kids, if they say closing the gap by the third grade with reading scores, they're sending them off to a very dismal future. And many books have been written about how they build jail systems based on third grade scores. Because they know if you're not successful, it's frustration in middle school. Frustration turns into combat and bullying by the time you get to high school. And if they don't find something to get them off of their path, every now and then they'll run across a teacher who says, look, you can do better. I believe in you. Do this. Join this club with me. I'll make sure you do this or the other to keep your mind on a positive venue. But a lot of our kids don't have those kind of advocates. And we need that pressure. Pressure on the school board, pressure on county commissioners, because those county commissioners, some of them represent those same areas. And if they're not focusing in attention, I mean public attention on those schools, I'll give credit to Equity, they changed the name now, Equity for Action, Action for Equity, the nonprofit group that really got involved in holding them accountable. They did, in fact, I helped them make a documentary because of my background in education on what they really have to look for to do just that. You got to hold those decision makers accountable to make decisions that put us on a par, at least on a par. I came through when nothing less than excellence was expected of you. You know, in my household, if you didn't bring home all A's, you went in trouble with my mama. I mean, my dad, I hated for her to say one thing, I'm going to tell your dad on you. I mean, that put fear, that froze you in your shoes almost. Oh, my God, I got to wear all day. Daddy's going to come home. Oh, Lord, what am I going to do? But that element, unfortunately, has left the community. And so who's in charge now? Those policymakers on the school board, those policymakers on the county commissioners. And then sometimes it takes public outcry beyond that to show up, let your community know what your concerns are, and to show out every now and then and say, look, here's a child, second grade, doesn't even know his letters. Now, you know, my wife, as you know, Brother Sean, taught teachers how to teach reading for a number of years at the university. And she would come home frustrated sometimes and say, baby, you know, I have potential teachers who can't even pass my introductory vocabulary test. He said, I got to tell her, no, education is not for you. You don't have the basic skill level to be an educator. And she had to do that quite often because, you know, they used to call her Ella Mean Mean instead of Ella Mean because she was, you know, she was no joke when it came to teachers because she would tell you straight up, you know, you got to be skilled, motivated, and love children to be an effective teacher. If you don't have those skill sets, choose another career.
I was thinking also, like, the question that was posed earlier, like, how do we get people motivated to make these decisions? And I think what you're sharing right now, like, tie it all the way down to how it affects you and your children, right? Like,
yes.
When you're voting, this is why you're voting, because this is how it's going to change. Because I remember when I was running for the state representative, that was a question that this African-American male asked me, this young guy. I was like, I vote for you, what you going to do for me? Right.
Right. straight up question. No chase on that one.
Right. So, but I had to let him know that voting for someone who cares about the community, and this is how it's going to affect you.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm supporting this is how it's going to affect you. So I think to your point, those are the things that I think, you know, messages and churches really need to focus on, bringing that home to a place where people can relate to, right? How does it affect me?
Because
at the end of the day, that's what people worry about. Like, if I vote, how's it going to affect me? You know, what I'm going to get out of this, basically. So I think that's a really good point. I'm not sure how we locally, I know you're here in Winston, how do we create, and I know there's other organizations out here in the community that's doing good work, but how do we create this space where we're answering that, where we ask ourselves that question, but come up with some solutions to solve it, right? Like, what if I vote for this person, how is this going to affect me? And how do I hold this person accountable? And if they say they're going to improve schools, are they doing it? You know, so I think those are the fundamental things when it comes to, like, people don't want, you know, younger people just don't want to vote because how is it affecting me? I don't see the payout in this, right?
Right, right. Well, we're going to hold that question and probably run another PSA and come back to try to answer some more potential solutions. What is the payout when you vote? What is the payout when I vote? What do you look for in a politician when you vote or support that person? And how do you hold that person accountable as they, you know, elect your interests or represent your interests, if indeed they're doing that? How do we hold them accountable? So after this next PSA, I hope we'll continue this discussion. You're listening to Map 5, and our honored guest today is LaShawn Hanley. And God willing, we'll have another guest to come on very shortly. I'm sure she's not on because probably something came up, but we respect her anyway. So we run a PSA, please. We'll come back in just a few minutes. The Map 5 on AM 360. Might be a little technical issue. We can continue our conversations until the technology catches up with the human voices here.
Okay, I'll go with the PSA, Brother Simmons.
All right, then.
Assalamu alaikum. This is your brother, Kareem Hali, inviting you to join in the study group of the lecture of Imam Warasuddin Muhammad Rahimallah Alayhi. Broadcast Saturday morning at 6 a.m. Central Standard Time here on American Muslim 360. The first hour, we shall play a lecture or address from Imam Warasuddin Muhammad Rahimallah Alayhi. And in the second hour, we shall open up the telephone line and share with each other the various beneficial points of interest contained in the lecture or address. So join the study group of the lectures of Imam Warasuddin Muhammad Rahimallah Alayhi on the evolution of revolutionary thought and created purpose every Saturday at 6 a.m. Central Standard Time on American Muslim 360. Let's share. Thank you.
Okay, men, this is your time. Maybe you didn't choose this, but you're here now. You're going to go out there and be an all-star caregiver. It's up to you. So what are you going to do? You're going to go grocery shopping, cook, clean, be there emotionally and physically. You got to dig deeper. Drive them to physical therapy, doctor's appointments. Don't you forget about the pharmacy. No, you won't. Because that's what caregivers do. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. This is your time to show the world, your family, and yourself that you're tougher than tough. Now go out there and be the best caregiver this world has ever seen. Caregiving is tougher than tough. Find the care guides you need at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement.
Hi, I'm Sebastian Maniscalco, and my grandfather passed away from Alzheimer's disease in 2005. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America is a national nonprofit agency that's here to help. If you or someone you love has questions about the disease, need someone to talk to, pick up the phone. Call Alzheimer's Foundation of America. Don't be embarrassed. They're here to help you. Call 866-232-8484. Don't forget.
Okay, we're back, Brother Fermi.
All right. Welcome back to Map 5. We're honored this evening to have Mr. LaShawn Hendley with us discussing community engagement and, of course, civic responsibilities. We've had a very lively discussion so far, and we'll continue the discussion. The last question raised was, how do we get young people to a great degree involved, and how do we keep them involved, you know, in this process, especially when it comes to these elected officials, and how do we hold these elected officials accountable to make sure they do what they say they're going to do once they raise their hand and take that oath to be an elected official. And that's a big task, I think, on, to a great degree, every citizen. How do you hold your elected officials accountable? And there are certain duties they're responsible for. In fact, if you look at that oath very carefully, and I'll just sort of abbreviate it, it says fundamentally, I've taken an oath to defend domestic and enemies to the Constitution abroad, locally and nationally and internationally for that matter. I'm not giving you the exact quote, but you basically take an oath to defend what's called the U.S. Constitution against common enemies in this country, outside of this country, because that document called the U.S. Constitution really summarizes your basic fundamental rights as a citizen in this country. So if you're not going to take the position to defend those rights and protect them against domestic and foreign enemies, you're basically saying you're not going to be an elected official with any kind of dedication to a common cause of everybody that you represent. And sometimes people take that for granted. There's a direct link for those of us who are the, you know, Islamic faith between our constitutions and the first constitution presented in Medina by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, called the Medina Charter. We spent a lot of time over the weekend dealing with some of those elements, especially in the Bill of Rights. That First Amendment in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to petition the government, a lot of that language is verbatim to the Medina Charter. So we take it for granted. We think it's an American idea when, in fact, it's really an Islamic principle. So we should be the ones waving the flag of participation, waving the flag of civic responsibility, waving the flag of dedicating the best image of yourself, and that being a basic fundamental human being endowed by your Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among those rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That should be our mode of operation. So for those elected officials who don't comply with those concepts, who find themselves compromised in many cases, and what comes to mind is a young man, and when I lived in Ohio, he was the mayor of Detroit. We had such high hopes for him. He spoke well. Then he got into a situation where they discovered he had packages of money frozen in a freezer, and his girlfriend got upset with him and spilled the beans, as they say, on the young brother. He lost his whole future in politics behind that. And unfortunately, we had a situation in Charlotte, North Carolina, a young brother who was somewhat set up, you know, and they do that sometimes too to see what kind of principles she really have. And he fell for the bait and took the bribery. It was a bribery charge that brought her against him. And I was somewhat loosely acquainted with some of his efforts because I knew who was involved in training him to become an elected official. But if you don't have principles that you stand upon of honesty and integrity, you won't really last very long in the political arena. And, of course, we all know about the one that's been on TV with the young man from New York who lied in all four directions. yes, he finally got kicked out of Congress, but he thought he could get away. I mean, just deception. You know, con man extraordinaire. And I won't even get into the tweeter himself, who's nothing more than a sophisticated con man, but that's a whole different apprenticeship program we should talk about later. But
yeah, but Santos, you know, they said that in one day, apparently he does something online where he gives a personalized meme or something like that. And they said in one day he raised more money than his congressional salary.
Yes, yes. So, sadly, people are gullible for that kind of thing. And how do you trust someone who lies 100 times a day? But he's making those little YouTube, you know, what do you call them? Not, is it YouTube or something else? It's another name for it now.
Thing for TikTok or something like that.
TikTok, thank you very much.
So
you know, I'm telling my age now. All right. yes, those little TikTok, you know, tidbits, you know, and all of a sudden you're going to believe this guy after all he has done. But he's making money, making those little tidbits, you know, presenting that false image, talking about the number of Botox in his face to keep his face smooth. I said, Lord, how much people really go for that stuff, you know. But that's because
they have been successful at dumbing American public down, right?
Yes.
Where we'll
no
go for anything.
And it's an image concept. And many of us know that images has a personality of its own. If you just fall for the image, you lose your credentials to think, because an image is temporary. Every image will change in time. And it's just your essence is not your image. Your essence is your intellect. You know, how do you think? But you can't put intellect in a book and sell it. You know, you put a picture up there and people fall for the yoke-a-doke on the picture. And that's how they move the whole marketing economy. They make people believe in those images. I'll never forget one professor I had in graduate school in Arizona. He used to always use his example of Chanel number 5. He said, I got a bottle of this, you know, a very expensive Chanel number 5, and why do you think they market this the way they do besides a very expensive automobile? And usually with a female in the commercial, everybody, you know, trying to figure out what he's talking about. He said it's very simple. And he worked on Fifth Avenue in New York as a premier marketeer for a number of different companies. He said, when we package a marketing plan, we sell one idea only. It's a psychological word. And in this case, it's hope. So I said, Professor, what do you mean by hope? He said, well, when you buy this product, you hope you can get this lady standing beside the car. And then he went through the psychological thing they did. It's a false hope they build and create in you that makes you think that, indeed, you buy this product and all of a sudden things will happen. And then he shared something else. He said, you know, and they said all this marketing they do, there's no scientific base. That what you see on TV, you're going to go out and purchase. But people spend millions of dollars on advertisement. But most people are sold by word to mouth. It's not stuff on TV, but you'd be surprised. 15 seconds can cost you $5 million. And it's more than that when it comes to the Super Bowl. But it's just an image. They sell images. It's an image-generated economy, and people identify with that image because they see themselves, sadly, in that image, unfortunately.
Right.
That is the big problem, you know.
Jackson was onto something when he said, keep hope alive, huh?
Yes. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right, you know. But I think I got off course a little bit. Shoshana, you had a specific issue you raised as we went to the commercials. Please repeat your concern so we can respond to it. As our program unfortunately ends at 3 o'clock, and I want to make sure we do justice to your question.
I think my question was the same question that the young lady raised at the beginning, you know, the question around how do we get individuals, young people, you know, interested in voting. And so, you know, to say, you know, like, me to vote because of our ancestors and history. That's good for some people, but some people need, like she mentioned, you know, the wig snatch. I mean, what do we need to do to grab the people's attention and say, this is the reason why you should vote, because this is how it affects you. And then what's the campaign we need to put in place to make sure we communicate this information? Like, say, for instance, I voted for politician X or elected official X, how to hold him or her accountable for what they said, you know, consistently in a way where we say, okay, well, this person no longer represents the community, or this person represents the community because of this, this, this. That's a lot of unpacking that probably need to be done, but I just want to make sure we stay focused on, because I think at the end of the day, how do we get young people engaged enough to vote?
Right.
Because I think that's the thing. You know, we sandwiches all day long, but there's still a certain population of our people who just don't vote because they're saying, what is it going to do for me, basically?
Right. Yes, sir. Well, I'll give you two quick examples, and we'll let other people contribute as well. I was asked to come to Carver High School, where three of my kids graduated from, to speak to the civics class. And the brothers who invited me wanted me to talk about a certain issue related to how this country started speaking English when the vote was decided what the language was going to be for this country. And I had a little background on that. But I said, you know what, it might help if we just ask the students, what are their concerns in the school right now that they'd like to impact it, to see a change in? Guess what it was? The cafeteria food. So I said, okay, cafeteria food. Who makes decisions on what's going to be in the cafeteria? Let's start there and see what we can come up with. Now, the premise I use with them, you know, we have a program called ACE, Ambassador for Civic Engagement. It's for young people for the most part. I said, well, we need a couple of ambassadors. We're going to do a little research for us. We're going to do a little bit of this right now in class, and you can take it further. Here's the first question. Who do you think has the authority to suggest to you what the menu will be in the cafeteria? Who's making that decision? And who can you talk to if you have a concern about changing it? And really, who is the policy decision maker behind that whole thing in the cafeteria if you want to get better food in there? And, you know, they heed and hawed and thought about it for a little bit. And their first response was, it must be the principal. I said, well, who controls the principal? What he can and cannot do? Who hires the principal? Silence, you know. I said, well, there's a group of people called the school board. They meet on Tuesdays. And they're the ones who make final decisions on who the principal's going to be. And they hold them accountable for making decisions that affect the school on a day-to-day basis. The menu in that cafeteria, to a great degree, is decided by two sources. The principal can impact it, but then they have something called, you know, federal dollars for free lunches in there, too. And they're somewhat limited on what they can offer. But you start with that principal and that school board. Let them know that you think the food needs to be changed in there, and get your group together. Give some recommendations. Start there and see what kind of impact you might have. And don't get impatient. It may take you 6 months to see a difference, but start now. Come up with your plan. Come up with your strategy. Come up with where you're going to implement it. And then come back to this class and evaluate your results of your effort. And they get all excited about that. I said, once you do that, I want you to consider joining ACE. Because that way you have a vehicle for the next issue, because it won't just be one issue going forward. You're going to run across something else you don't like, perhaps, or you'd like to see some changes in. And it's your right to address those concerns and to make those changes, because it's your life. The bottom line is your life is sacred. Your life is sacred fundamentally. So anything that threatens the sanctity of your life, you want to see some adjustments in that. And that's keeping it real, you know. So that changed the whole curriculum approach a young teacher had. He said, well, Tom, you were pretty good about getting them to even speak. I have a hard time getting them to speak up in class. I said, well, I've been doing this for a while. I have a little bit of experience, about 40 years in the classroom, so you got to listen to kids. You can't just tell kids. You got to listen to them very carefully. And in many cases, they will tell you if you're listening. Now, if you're occupied trying to tell them, that's a whole different conversation. In fact, it's a one-way conversation. So you got to listen to them. See what their concerns are. And you're not going to get 25 students. If you get 5 on an issue, you've done well, because those 5 can influence others, you know. So I'm never impressed with numbers too much. I'm impressed with your focus, your mission, what you're trying to achieve. And young people, they're like sincere people. You know, they can read you real quickly. In fact, that's where they have their best intelligence, emotional intelligence. So if you come up with them and you're just not sincere, they'll read you in a heartbeat. Say, man, how can you say this, man? You're not for real, man. I don't believe you, man. You know, man, what's happening, man? What's the real deal with you, man? And they'll just cut you to the chase and just tell you what's going on, you know. But you got to listen. So listen is first. And then give them some constructive activity they can engage in to make a difference and challenge them to make it work. And then you work with them as much as you can. And they'll see that you're committed to their life quality and not just talking that talk, just to hear yourself speak. Anyone else want to add to that?
Well, that was very comprehensive, I think, Brother Fleming. I just think that we've had in this last year a couple of good examples. The two young Justins in Tennessee were very involved in that because of the gun violence. You know, they kind of rose to the top, and then they highlighted other disparities in that government there, that local government. And then also the young man who was one of the survivors from that Pulse, again, gun violence, who ran for office. I see his face. I'm trying to think of his name. He's the youngest congressperson there now.
Yes, exactly. You're talking about. Yes, ma'am.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
So I think maybe when they see more young people and more young people come to the front, and like you said, who can talk their language. I think Killer Mike was very influential in Atlanta as far as influencing people to get out to vote. So I think when we can get more young people speaking up about the importance of voting and people that they admire, that is a place to start. But, of course, there have to be people that can give them something of substance to help them to know that it's a commitment more than just voting, that the voting is just the first step. You know, you have to then become more engaged and more involved. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, that's the essence of it right there, actually. And then, you know, there are... On the newspaper, if you got a daily newspaper, they publish voting records of your senators and your congressmen on a pretty regular basis. But the average person doesn't read those votes. But you got to have a way of measuring people, especially elected officials, by the votes that they take. Now, sometimes that takes effort because somebody's got to be present or somebody's got to be listening to those meetings and writing down, you know, those issues. And this public information. But then you see how those votes impact your community, and you assess that. And I'll end with this. We have a neighbor whose yard is being, oh, my God, she's lost about maybe a fourth of her backyard because a creek is eroding. And, you know, so I had a county person come out and look at the property, and he said there were some state funds that might be available to help with that erosion problem. I said, this is not a state problem. This is a local county issue here, and we have an environmental department responsible for making sure this kind of thing doesn't happen. Long story short, finally the state came in. They provided some funds to try to arrest some of that destruction of her personal property. And she says, you know, Fleming, I've been living in this community for 30 years, and you're the only one that sent anybody out here to even look at my problems. And I said, well, you know, everybody has a different motivation. So I can do what I can do to help. That's all I can say about that, you know. But that again is an example. You got to have people who have your interests genuinely at heart, and then you hold them accountable by simply watching their voting record and see how often they show up in your community when it's not an election. That's very, very critical to going forward.
Yeah.
And for the young people listening, you know, there are efforts, so internships available to get you involved in this whole, you know, political arena if you're interested. Just make the right contacts with the right people. Either the American Coalition for Good Government is one of those, ACGG, and we can direct you to some other resources if you're interested. We're looking for 5 people now to send to Malaysia to get involved in banking systems because they want to invest in some entities in America using Islamic banking principles. So the opportunity is out there. So don't be discouraged. The sun shines every day. And I always say, young people, whenever you feel alone, just put your index finger to your nose and breathe. That hot air in your body comes from one source and is always with you. You're never alone. You always have someone with you. So just be connected. And you perhaps will be inspired from realizing you're always connected to a higher authority. I know that we're running low on time. I think it's almost 3 o'clock, isn't it?
Yes, time has expired.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for listening to Map 5. Stay tuned for next Monday, same time, same station, for another hopefully quality program concerning your issues. Stay engaged, stay informed, and be a motivator to help someone else besides yourself to become a better person in life. Thank you again. May the God's peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.